Welcome back. Before we begin, I just wanted to introduce a new assistant director we have, that Matt Esposito, who's coming to us from Citibank. So, Matt, welcome. I'll turn it over to Stephen McKinney to tee this issue up.
All right, thanks, Russ. So today we'll be discussing certain clarifications regarding the estimate of expected credit losses as discussed in the FASB's proposed update. So now if I could turn your attention to Memo 239 and ISB Agenda Reference 5F. So as discussed in July's feedback summary, a number of issues were raised during outreach and in comment letters about the FASB's intent regarding the term expected credit losses. Today's discussion focuses on what the staff believes are necessary clarifications regarding the FASB's intentions around the terms expected credit losses. These clarifications relate to whether an entity is required to forecast economic conditions over the entire life of an asset, how the term all contractual cash flows should be interpreted within the definition of expected credit losses, clarification of the measurement principle regarding the use of multiple scenarios, clarification of whether certain loss rate approaches implicitly contemplate the time value of money, and lastly, whether to provide application guidance for how an entity might assess current conditions and develop forecasts about the future. So as stated in the feedback summary on the FASB's proposed update, it's clear that there's a broad misunderstanding that an entity is required to forecast economic conditions over the entire life of an asset. This misconception led to constituents raising concerns that forecasting and predicting economic conditions over the remaining life of an asset would be operationally challenging and would result in providing information to users that's both inaccurate and unreliable. The staff believes that this was not the FASB's intention to require an entity to forecast economic conditions over the life of an asset. As a result, the staff believes that a final standard on expected credit losses that requires a lifetime loss estimate must clarify that an entity is not required to forecast economic conditions over the life of an asset and require an entity to revert to an unadjusted historical average loss experience for the periods beyond those that are reasonably and supportably forecasted. So I'll turn it back over to the board for the first question of this paper. So does the FASB agree with the staff's recommendation on how to clarify whether an entity is required to forecast economic conditions over the entire life of the loan in order to estimate expected credit losses?
Tom?
I agree with the staff recommendation, with the clarification what we mean by reversion to the mean. Some might think reversion to the mean says jump back to the mean immediately outside that reasonable and supportable forecast period. That's not what I believe reversion to the mean means. I think it means bring it back to the mean over the remaining period of the asset's life. And I would say if you've got data to support the ability to do that over that time period, use that reversion and the path of reversion that is supported by your data. Otherwise, I would accept a practical expedient that would suggest that if the remaining useful life beyond the reasonable and supportable forecast period is X years, ratably move it back to the mean over that time period.
Larry?
Yeah, I somewhat agree with Tom. I thought Hal brought up some good points at the education session, and I guess in my mind, you know, this is an estimate. I don't think we really need to be prescriptive. I think we say the objective is to go back to the mean. For those people that really feel uncomfortable with, you know, taking it back over the remaining life, or don't have any data to support how to take it back, I think they can revert to the mean. And other people, I would allow them to revert to the mean over time if they have some data to support it or what have you. I don't think we have to get overly prescriptive, but we can state what the objective is.
Yeah.
Just to Larry's point, we're going to require a disclosure about several things, one of which is this aspect of reversion to the mean. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And in the implementation guidance, we can have this discussion and say basically, if in most situations, some general or overtime reversion to the mean would be most applicable. We recognize that in certain cases, it may not always work, and just describe that. So at least the investors would be forewarned or armed. Is that fair way of summarizing?
Yes.
And I think that this issue was highlighted actually by the banks during our feedback and pointing out the significant differences that could result. So I think that this having the reversion over time would actually be responsive to the feedback that we heard and solve some of the problems.
Yeah, can you help me understand better what is meant by revert to the mean? Let's assume my historical statistical data is 5% at default, and my most current estimate of current and expected conditions for the foreseeable future is 6%. And after that, I don't know. Okay, by definition, it's beyond foreseeable. Why should I go back to 5% instead of staying at 6%? Absent any further information.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a possibility. When the staff came out with a frequently asked questions document in March, there were two options that the staff discussed. One was to revert to the historical mean, and the other was to effectively, as you said, freeze kind of those economic conditions at that point. And I think just upon further reflection, I think the staff got concerned with allowing an entity to continue to kind of freeze those conditions from that, I guess, furthest point that you could evaluate and continue to freeze that because we were worried about manipulation.
But at the end of the day, if the entity felt comfortable with that 6%, you know, such effectively it just extended its foreseeable future or the period over which it can predict things. So, you know, I think in your situation, if that entity did not think it was appropriate to go back to the mean at 5%, I would argue that the period over which they they felt that they had reasonable and supportable estimates was actually longer than the original.
Because they would be adjusting that mean for a longer period of time,
right,
based on something,
okay,
right?
It would be a new mean.
Exactly.
But the main reason we didn't freeze it, Philippe, is that when we did our 2010 ED in the impairment, we had said just that. We said the best shot on what the current information is and basically freeze it, right? And that's the life. And all the feedback that we had was, well, that doesn't make sense at all. Based on my current most available information, you know, it also might change. So then we said, okay, well, we got to open it up and allow for reasonable and supportable forecasts. And but that doesn't mean, you know, and then people said, but are you asking me to then forecast out 30 years for a 30-year mortgage? Well, no. So where we are is kind of just the result of a long journey of saying, well, no, you could adjust your forecasts out, but to the extent that you then don't know beyond any foreseeable future, this just says revert back to the historical average because we don't think, you know, the choice is really zero for after the foreseeable future, freeze it, or, you know, or go back to the mean. And so at least I think we go back to the mean.
Jim Crawford?
I agree with, I think it was Larry that said not being too prescriptive. This is a huge estimate. Obviously, you're in further periods where you can't see. So I like the notion of reversion over time, sort of when it makes sense. What I don't know is when it doesn't make sense. So I wouldn't want to be too prescriptive. And maybe Larry's solution of providing that flexibility, some operational guidance around that.
Are you defining how you calculate the historical average? Is it the last 5 years, or the average life of the product, or the life of the entity? I'm not clear on where the mean comes from.
Yeah, I mean, I think your historical experience for the asset. So if you're looking at an asset that has an average historical life, you know, considering, I guess, parts of the next question that we're going to tee up, you know, taking into account prepayments, et cetera. Think about, let's just say, a 30-year mortgage in the U.S., effectively the average life of that asset is really 8 years. You have to have historical experience for 8 years in order to kind of come up with that historical average. But I don't think we're going to be overly prescriptive in actually how you calculate that.
And I think one of the reasons...
But 30 years would be wrong.
Yeah, correct.
In that
right.
scenario.
Correct. If we answer the second set of questions
right.
in that way.
Depending on how...
Okay. But the outcome could be quite different depending on which 8-year period
right.
you chose,
yeah.
right?
So are you confident that saying reversion to the mean will always get you sort of truing up to the right number?
The last question deals with that issue. And it sort of says, okay, there's maybe two or three steps to getting this rate. And the first step is the base. All right? And the base is through the cycle for a period of time. And it's based on the information that you have there. The next step is to evaluate whether current condition and reasonable supportable forecasts, the information inherent in the current information, that how it differs from the base, and so how the base is not representative of the risk position now, and to make an adjustment from whatever your base is to a more representative current risk position.
Ian?
I guess I'm going to say pretty much what Sue said. I have a worry that, in some cases, the unadjusted historical averages may be in no relevance to expected losses at all. I mean, there's nothing to say that history is going to teach us what goes into the future. You know, if you look at the Spanish Central Bank with its dynamic provisioning, that was all based on the fact they could estimate economic cycles, and then they just proved they couldn't. So I'd be really worried about pinning people back, even in a casual way, to historical figures.
So would that lead you to stop at the foreseeable future or not answer the question about what you do when you go past reasonable supportable forecast?
You can only use reasonable supportable forecast and not to pass. Yeah. But going back may or may not be the right thing to do in circumstances.
On that point, I think some...
Hold on.
Do
you want to get in, Jim?
I think it gets to whether then you should assume zero is a better outcome. So you can't predict that portion of the future, and I think at least some of us thought it.
Not zero.
Well, but I think you said you would truncate at foreseeable future. So if you truncated that, I think then the remainder of the period is zero
for
everything. Yeah.
Larry,
but as Tom indicated, the last question that we have in this paper addresses it. And in paragraph 24, you'll see a series of different things that people ought to consider in whether they are comfortable with the historical rate or whether they need to adjust it. But the point is, we don't feel comfortable that zero is an appropriate amount.
So you're reverting to the adjusted rate.
Right.
In another question, we'll say that in building that base, you must use multiple scenarios to get the probability of loss. So it's not just one eight-year period. It's got to be multiple, probably weighted scenarios to get the base risk of loss.
I canceled the mic. But I'm just curious, you know, at stage two, are we proposing the same methodology for like this, you know, mean to historical reversion to lifetime? At stage two.
Go ahead, sir. I think we'd always think that the historical information is always probably your most important anchor when you look out over the life, and you'd be making sort of the most specific adjustments you can for the forecast period that you're talking about. And then after that, you'd be taking into account what the historical was and then thinking about the extent to which it needs to be adjusted based upon differences in where that was determined versus the circumstances that you see today and estimate to the extent you can in the future. So I think if you don't have much visibility at all, maybe the best reasonable and supportable information you do have is the historical, but not necessarily. So I think we are similar in the sense of talking about the anchor. I think the only thing is the sort of use of the require word would be the only thing that would cause me to hesitate slightly.
I think we're over-engineering this in some respects to vote on this particular item. Your example, 5% historical through a, you got a 5-year duration asset, you've got 5 years of 5-year history through the cycle at that time period, and then you've got to adjust it for current conditions and reasonable supportable forecasts that say that for the next 2 years it might be up to 6%, but there's still going to be losses emerging after that 2-year period of time. You jump it to 6%. Or do you say, no, it's probably going to come back down. I'm going to have to make my best estimate of how much I don't move it up to 6%, somewhere between 5 and 6, yeah, based on some thought process about the economics.
If I may, as a minimum, I would say that absent any evidence that it will go back to 5%, because you don't know by definition, I would have a new average, which is 5%, updated with a 2 years or 3 years of 6%, which makes 5.8%. I will revert to this new average, a new base, which is a new statistical series, instead of reverting to the old one and just forgetting the most recent information. But because I don't think, as Ian said, you can assume that the old historical information is more relevant than the most current one. You can't assume it.
Have you kept the same definition of lifetime loss or the same objective? My understanding was that there was a very clear objective principle, which is that the losses, the present value of the cash you don't expect to collect, allowing for prepayments, discounted at the EIR. So is that sort of fundamental principle still the same, and this is just talking about the application of the principle or the yes. guidance?
Yes.
So that wording will still be there?
Well, although we do have subsequent questions that might touch upon some of that.
A practical expedient in certain circumstances.
But
the PDF and the cash flows you don't expect to collect, discounted back at the EIR, is far easier to apply if you come to an individual asset that you're working out and can actually think about the cash flows in that asset. We have to think about, because this has to be applied to portfolios also, where you still have not identified the asset where the problem is, there's going to be a little bit of a challenge in being able to predict two time periods exactly where those losses, where the cash flows you're not going to collect will occur. And so we're going to talk about a practice.
That's the discounting thing. I was meant in the context of this.
But that's where we're saying there's going to be, that's the objective, but it's going to be harder to pull that off in a portfolio context at times, and then we'll come up with a practical expedient for that if we vote the way the memo says.
Okay, so what I hear from the conversations are the staff's recommending that in forecasting lifetime losses, you're not expected to forecast economic conditions over the life of the asset. Rather, for future periods beyond which the entity is able to make reasonable support of forecast, and is expected to revert to the unadjusted historical average. So I'm going to first start with that, and then I'm going to go on to say how much additional detailed application guidance does the board want to have as to how to do that. That seems to be the critical point. With respect to the first question, and I've really read language in paragraph 5, by show of hands, who agrees with that? FASB. Okay, all 7. Okay, with respect to how descriptive we want to be, Tom, I think Tom would prefer to be more descriptive and Larry would prefer to be less descriptive, right? So who by show of hands wants to be more descriptive? Not even Tom?
No, I want to be more descriptive, but I don't want to be overly specific. I don't want to say
okay, so
specific.
So let me ask it this way.
I was going to say, you said in your questioning, revert to the historical, and I would have said things like revert to an historical to allow for some flexibility here.
The language in paragraph 5 says the entity is expected to revert to an unadjusted historical average.
Okay,
let me ask, who members of the FASB, who would agree with basically the concept in paragraph 5, and at this point, no additional application guidance, by show of hands?
No additional?
I wouldn't describe it that way. I would just say that we add...
I'm trying to get your vote.
I know you are. I would just add a sentence or two that says there might be a variety of ways to accomplish this and give an example or two or something like that. That's all.
Okay.
Russ, I had a question before you go ahead with your vote. When you refer to paragraph 5, I read 5B. It says require an entity to revert, and then down in the small text, it says expected to revert. Should I read those two sentences differently or the same?
I think what the staff is proposing is that you do not, you go out as far as you can foresee, mm-hmm. and you don't stop there. You're required to consider going to the unadjusted historical average. I think the debate was, and our original proposal was, you would continue with that assumption.
And so I think you're required to consider changes to that. I think that's what 5B is saying, and then the smaller print is the actual language we put in.
Russ, why I want a little bit more is I don't want constituents applying this to have to go through a great justification process for exactly what they've done. So I agree with Larry. There can be multiple ways of going forward. You could do it like Philippe wants to. You could do it the way the staff suggested, jump back to the an historical adjusted mean immediately, or you could do it over time. I think we should say that. If you choose a method, you should be able to justify it. But if there's no way to justify it, I thought telling them what a practical expedient might be so they don't have to get hung up in justifying with data extensively what they're going to be doing would be a far more operable thing to do than just say you do it and then the auditors can challenge them as to why they did it the way they did it, unless we say there's a practical expedient.
That would tell me you shouldn't use the word required.
Well, we weren't.
Okay.
So can we do this? Can we add the additional sentences Larry's talking about it and then see if we think there can be some consistent application? We need to do additional application guidance?
Yeah, I would be all right with adding some couple of sentences like that, but I would be very hesitant about adding some examples because we start adding examples, then people, if they believe truly that they have a way that's better to do it for them than one of those examples, they're going to have to justify that, and it's an unending argument.
Okay. Any objections to that? All right. We'll go to the next question.
All right, so during the exposure period, the staff received three main questions on the FASB's intention with the phrase, all contractual cash flows. Does the expected credit loss estimate represent a life of loan estimate? Should prepayments be taken into consideration when estimating expected credit losses? And whether and how an entity considers renewals, extensions, modifications, and expansions? The staff believes that the FASB's FAQ document issued in March addresses the first two questions. The FAQ document states that the FASB believes that all contractual cash flows refer to cash flows over the entire contractual term of a financial asset, so in effect the life of the loan. But then an entity consider expected prepayments that shorten the expected life of a loan when estimating expected credit losses. As a result, the staff recommends that the FASB clarify that the term all contractual cash flows refers to cash flows over the entire contractual term of the financial asset and would consider expected prepayments on an asset's expected life when determining the estimate of expected credit losses. Now, in light of the staff's discussion on prepayments, however, constituents have questioned whether an entity is required to consider renewals, extensions, and modifications when evaluating an expected life of a financial instrument. Some have suggested that it would be inconsistent to require an entity to consider the effect of prepayments while allowing it to ignore the effects of renewals, extensions, and modifications on an asset's expected life. So while the staff can appreciate constituent feedback regarding renewals, extensions, and modifications, the staff believes that the phrase all contractual cash flows is generally limited to the current legal terms of the arrangement. However, the staff also understands that if a lender reasonably expects that it will execute a troubled debt restructuring, the lender will likely use its estimate of expected cash flows, which may include interest payments for years beyond the current contractual term when estimating expected credit losses as of the balance sheet date. Some have suggested that doing so provides the most accurate depiction of expected credit losses, and prohibiting such an approach would artificially require that a lender assume that a borrower will refinance externally. As a result, the staff recommends that the FASB clarify that an entity would not consider renewals, extensions, and modifications when estimating all contractual cash flows unless the entity reasonably expects that it will execute a troubled debt restructuring. So the three questions related to this area are effectively all this are around the same topic. So I guess we probably should just tackle those all at once. So the first one has to do with whether the term all contractual cash flows refers to cash flows over the entire contractual term of the financial asset, so in effect the life of the loan, whether the entity should consider expected prepayments, and then lastly the question about renewals, modifications, and expansions.
Mark, you want to talk about TDRs?
Just to say that I talked about it a long time last week, and I don't think I convinced three of you. I'm not sure I convinced one of you. So I'm okay with the staff recommendation, all this except the TDR part.
Okay. Any other comments?
And how did you word question four? We talked about should not be required.
Yeah.
We talked about
should
may
not,
consider.
Not
or should not consider.
It not should consider. Should not
should not consider. Okay.
Tom.
I generally agree with all the staff recommendations, but I think we could make the issue about TDRs a little bit clearer. I think certain extensions, renewals, and modifications are within GAAP view to be new loans. And new loans we would not consider in the contractual cash flows of the current loan, any new loan that's associated with a renewal, modification, or extension. However, we've made a decision that TDRs are not a new loan, but the workout of the collection of the cash flows of the current loan. And given that a TDR that is a workout of the collection of the cash flows of the current loan, we would consider what you will collect and the amount of loss related to a TDR.
Mary?
Mine was a question about renewals, but specifically the credit card issue that I think was floating in the background of some of ours, the earlier discussions. The feedback that we've heard was technically the contractual period may be a day, but entities may not monitor credit card balances at a level that permits them to cut it off, you know, 24 hours notice. So, you know, I think that was something they raised as a concern about consideration of any renewals. Would your conclusion on renewals apply to limit credit card receivables, you know, that could be canceled?
Current balance.
Yeah.
I mean, my first thought is that there are some issues that relate to credit cards that we will have to bring as a staff back to the board, because there are certain application difficulties, as you mentioned, kind of one of the issues today. But there are other issues around kind of contractual life for credit card receivables. And I think it's an item that is maybe specific to a credit card industry that we would have to bring back.
But perhaps the question is when you say extensions, renewals, and modifications, how are you dealing with things like lines of credit? That's not, it's my understanding, that was not considered renewal modifications or extensions. So the credit card is, there is a line of credit until it is shut down, right? So I don't think question four was designed to deal with lines of credit.
Okay.
Question four is designed to deal with, I have a two-year loan, and what I generally do is when Larry comes to me to refinance, I extend that loan, I have re-underwrite and I extend it. That's the scenario I think we're talking about here. Wegu?
Use one example to say, to test the meaning of extension and the old contractual cash flow. Now in UK, the popular mortgage loan is designed like this. You have 2 years period at lower rates, and then jump to a relatively high rate. It's all in the contract. And someone, quite often the case, the borrowers not noticed, you know, after 2 years, your interest, you know, part will increase dramatically. Let's assume, you know, the contract design like this. Let's assume over 90% or 60% of the borrowers didn't notice and just keep going. And my question to you is, the term after 2 years should be considered extension? Oh, no.
No, it's still one.
It's
correct.
So you mean
it's basically a variable rate.
Yeah.
Oh, the contractual cash flow.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Jim?
On the TDR, I thought it was a loss minimization or a profit maximization technique, so I wasn't troubled. But when Mark talked about it, the one thing I wanted to make sure is that we're not somehow double counting the impact. So if you're considering the TDR strategy in estimating loss, whether you should do something to assume then the TDR. I guess there was an issue of double counting. I'm sure we'll just work that out, but I think that Mark might have been part of your point, Mark.
Yeah, it's not. I think after subsequent discussions with the staff, I don't think we're double counting. Okay. It's not included. I don't think it's included in the overall loss rate on the portfolio level. No, my issue was simply like once you are in the individual level assessing the expected cash flows from a particular troubled loan, I don't think you should get credit for a modification that you have not yet exercised. And I would much rather have the expected loss be the full expected loss until such time as you actually exercise the TDR.
So, okay, I'm going to call a vote. With respect to questions 2 and 3 in the paper, by show of hands, who agrees with the staff's recommendation? So, 7. Okay, with respect to question 4, who agrees with the staff's recommendation? Okay, 6. And Mark's basis is what he just articulated about the TDR.
Staff, what was your reaction of the way I characterized the different extensions and modifications? Is that consistent with what you were thinking, or is that a productive way of doing it or not?
Could you recharacterize what you said before?
I don't think you have to. I mean, a TDR by definition is not a new loan.
Okay. Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. But, I mean, we probably could add a sentence talking about the continuation of an original loan.
Well, I don't even know if you have to, if what you do is say you do not consider the contractual cash flows related to these things that create a new financial instrument. Right. That means you would consider the cash flows related to TDR because they're not a new financial instrument.
Is that not a defined term in the glossary?
I was about to say, I mean, we do already mention that in the basis in the proposed update today. I would imagine that would continue to exist in the basis as well.
Pat?
Mark's discussion made me wonder, in doing the losses, don't you consider collateral?
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't wait until they sold the house before you included the cash flows of the collateral.
Right.
So why would you wait until they entered into the TDR to include the cash flows in the TDR?
It's a different contract. You're modifying a contract, and so I would wait till you actually go through the contract. But everybody else, nobody disagrees with that, so I don't want to belabor it, but I just think that it's, you know, it's a difference of opinion in the measurement issue.
When I heard in the education system your reservations, I was on the same page with you, but the more I thought about it, the less concerned I'd be, is because...
Sure, 23 other people already.
No. I give you the reason why.
So you're just going to give another reason why I lost?
It's the words here say reasonably expect, and it isn't within the control of the lender, right? So they know what they're going to do and what they're not going to do. And if they're going to make an extension, which could have an impact on the collateral and therefore the LGD, I think it's reasonable. It's not far-fetched.
It's fine. Again, my thought is I would prefer to wait because an entity is just – a bank could just say, I'm going to do a loss mitigation approach down the road sometime, and now you've been able to reduce a whole bunch of reserves.
There's a question. Follow my example, you know. Particularly during this financial crisis, the interest rate from maybe 5-6% down to 1%, and let's assume 90% or even more than 90% of the borrower not renewed, and they switch to another lender. Based on your decision, you should not consider repayment.
No, you would. They repaid that loan and got a new loan from someone else.
Consider prepayment.
You consider prepayments. You don't consider renewals and extensions.
Right.
The trick in this crisis is nobody could repay.
Consider repayments.
Consider repayments.
But not renewals. Sorry, but not extensions.
If you combine together the scenario I just described, you know, let's assume, you know, HSBC have 1,000 borrowers, mortgage borrowers, and under such scenarios, so you should consider prepayment.
Yes.
Not consider extension.
Yes.
But
because extensions are new loans, prepayments are the contractual cash flows of the existing loan.
So, what that means is that you're collecting your cash.
Don't consider impairments on loans you haven't made yet.
Right.
And we don't view a TDR as a new financial asset.
The contract is signed like this. You have the option to extend or prepay by the end of the 2 years.
I think that's just a loan that's prepayable. I don't think that's an extension. I think what we're talking about an extension is a situation where you and I have a 5-year loan, and I don't think he can repay me in 5, but I think he can repay me in 8. So then I then consider the extension. We're saying don't consider that extension. That's a 5-year loan.
Unless it's a TDR, then you would.
Exactly.
The difference between the 5 and the 8 is, the difference between the 5 and the 8 and a TDR is, in the 8 years, there's going to be additional contractual interest required for the 3 years. In a TDR, what you're going to end up doing is saying that contractual interest that you had originally, I will accept something less over and collect it over a different time period. That doesn't increase the contractual cash flows. It just says the time period over which you would collect the existing contractual cash flows.
Now, when I first asked, 2 years at low rate, extended at high rate, you said you should consider.
But that wasn't an
extension.
That was the loan agreement is much longer to begin with. It's just that your interest rate for the first 2 years is low, and for the subsequent years is higher.
It's a variable rate loan after two years.
If they keep paying.
Maybe we take it offline. We move on and take it offline. Yeah. Okay. Let's go on to the C.
So throughout the outreach, many constituents were confused about the FASB's intention with the requirement that an estimate of expected credit losses always reflect both the possibility that a credit loss results and the possibility that no credit loss results. Some suggest that even when an entity considers multiple outcomes, but none of those outcomes results in a credit loss, for example, on financial assets that are fully or over-collateralized, then the entity would not be complying with the proposed guidance. The staff believes that the FASB intended that the estimate of expected credit losses always reflects the risk of loss, even when that risk is remote. However, the staff also believes that the FASB never intended to require an entity to recognize a loss on a financial asset in which the risk of loss is greater than zero, yet the amount of loss would be zero. So as a result, the staff recommends that the FASB clarify that the estimate of expected credit losses should always reflect the risk of loss, even when that risk is remote. Furthermore, the staff believes that the FASB should clarify that an entity is not required to recognize a loss on a financial asset in which the risk of loss is greater than zero, yet the amount of loss would be zero. So the question for the board is, does the FASB agree with the staff's recommendation on how to clarify the measurement principle regarding the use of multiple scenarios?
Over-collateralized.
In your draft wording changes on the bottom of page 8,
yep.
Third line from the down from the bottom or up from the bottom, you're going to change loss to default.
Third line from the bottom, where it says situations in which the expected risk of loss.
Yes.
Correct me. This is what I think you're trying to say.
Okay.
The expected default. I thought we talked about
risk of non-payment.
Risk of non-payment.
The only worry that I had, or the staff had, with default was the implication that people would be using default statistics, a probability of default statistics all the time, PD, LGD, EAD. But I understood the point that Jim brought up last week as well. I don't know if that would completely change this word or this wording choice.
Jim?
Same point is, if we're going to add clarity, to have words that say the risk of loss is greater than zero, but the loss is zero, it might solve one problem, but it creates, I think, confusion saying mathematically how does that work.
Exactly.
So I'd like to say something like risk of non-payment. I understand all the sort of issues with default, but something different than the risk of loss and then suggesting that the risk is something but the loss is zero. And I think
so maybe non-payment is a little bit more clear than
Tom?
I agree generally with the staff recommendation, and I agree that we have some issues in communication. I think that what we have to make clear is that when considering in the steps towards getting recognizing amount of loss, that in all instances you have to consider the probability of a loss event. That is, but even in the situation when you have a positive probability of a loss event, when in determining the amount of the loss, you can adjust that and reflect the effect of having collateral. That separates it from the probability of loss event notion to once I have a positive probability with an exposure, that if I'm that exposure is covered by security, you can still result in having an amount that's zero. And so separate it a little bit and don't confound the collateralization issue with the probability of loss event issue.
Mark?
So I agree with those points on different word for the word loss. In the first paragraph under the changed wording, we crossed out a sentence that talked about it's not a worst case, you know, expected credit loss is not a worst case scenario, best case scenario. We put that in there for a reason, and I'm fine if you want to take it out of the standard, but I don't want to lose it completely. And so, you know, I wouldn't mind resurrecting it in the basis or something just to drill the point home. This is not a worst case, absolutely, you know, worst case scenario.
Go ahead.
I didn't complete that. What that means is the second paragraph on page 8 that you have in the revised wording, I would not have that last sentence in there when talking about the probability of a loss event. I would not jump right away to talking about collateral. I just say that you have to have a probability of loss and you got to consider both collections and non-collections. That should be positive, and later end up overriding that when you determine the amount of the loss.
Well, it's not overriding it, it's just
measurement. Considering it, you're right, considering it once you end up measuring the loss in a positive risk of loss or probability of loss event scenario. I think that's where people are getting confused, is juxtaposition.
So what I hear is we agree with the substance of the staff recommendation, which is the evaluation of the event is different than the evaluation of the actual loss amount, and we don't want to use the same word to describe those two different things.
Right.
And we can work in the detailed wording. So by show of hands, who would agree with that concept? Okay. Seven. Right. You guys are both in? Right.
Yeah. Yes.
Right. We're in.
So next one.
All right. The FASB's proposed update requires that an estimate of expected credit losses reflects the time value of money either explicitly or implicitly. Throughout our outreach, many constituents were confused about the FASB's intention with the time value of money and whether a discounted cash flow approach would be required. In addition, many constituents highlighted that various loss rate methods and probability of default methods will not necessarily reconcile perfectly to a DCF technique and are concerned about what it means to implicitly reflect the time value of money. These concerns led the staff to indicate in the FAQ document that the FASB decided that there are other acceptable methods of estimating expected credit losses in a manner that reflects the time value of money, even though some of the methods may not reconcile perfectly with a discounted cash flow approach. As a result, the staff recommends that the FASB clarify in the final standard which loss estimation methods would satisfy the time value of money principle. The staff believes that doing so would avoid external interpretation differences with the term implicit time value of money that's used in the model. So the question for the board is, does the FASB believe that the final standard on expected credit losses should indicate which loss estimation methods satisfy the time value of money principle as described in the staff's analysis?
Were you planning to identify those using our term as practical expedience? Because it seems like what you were just saying in the TF is they may not actually be consistent with the ideal calculation, but you want to bless a limited number of variants that would be used to approximate it without having to worry about materiality?
I think we could probably say certain methods are considered practical expedients for achieving the time value of money concept. But I'll let the board discuss whether practical expedient is the right title for that.
But
you're right, and that's effectively what we're talking about.
The concept is that it's just sometimes we have to be careful because there have been historical cases when we say practical expedient, and then we find out preparers are forced to prove that it actually is a practical expedient. So they'd have to do this methodology as well as a different methodology and prove there's an immaterial difference. We don't want that to happen. We just want you to use this. You have the right to use it. If you do, it's okay. That's the concept we're getting at.
I guess I was troubled by an assertion that these will achieve full reflection of the time value of money. You know, we've assessed them and they will achieve that. I take your point about not wanting to make somebody prove every time that the difference is immaterial, and that's separate discussion from asserting that these fully realize.
We're not going to say that. I mean, in the basis, we'll say that, look, the board thought the time value of money was was an objective we wanted to achieve, but from a practical standpoint, there are certain methodologies that are used that we know can be proven not to be entirely consistent with the time value of money or give you the conceptually pure answer, but the board is accepting them as acceptable.
So these are reasonable approximations kind of thing?
I'm not sure we can make that statement. We're just going to say that you can use them, period.
These are acceptable. Daryl Buck?
So is the point to identify the population of methods that are acceptable or to identify specifically some that aren't? And what I'm trying to get to here is it seems like by being this specific, it is a little bit contradictory to the decision we made at the first of this paper, where we decided not to be too specific on reversion to the mean and how someone might accomplish that. But here it seems like we're being very prescriptive. I'm just trying to figure out if this is sort of a negative prescription or a positive prescription.
But we're not saying you have to use these. We're saying you can use them.
Right. So it is some that can be used.
Right, and they do satisfy this time value of money.
But
concept.
We will clearly say that you can use others as well.
If you're doing a single loan 114 type of an analysis, that does reflect the time value of money, specifically the way the boards had originally intended.
Okay.
And you're still permitted to do that.
And all of these are plural. Cash flow methods, discount methods.
Okay. Got it.
They reflect, to Mary's point, they reflect, and it's consistent with, so we're not saying they are, it's just, it's in the ballpark.
Okay. All right.
Tom?
Well, first of all, I think in paragraph 22 of the memo, in paragraph 825.15.25.4, the statement that a provision matrix using Locke's factors all reflect the time value money in a manner consistent with this principle is not true. And we have to be clear that we don't make that statement. I think we should say that if you are doing a loss estimation on individual loans where you can identify the cash flows not to be collected, you should use a discounted cash flow model discounting at the effective interest rate. Otherwise, if you cannot identify the cash, otherwise, I don't want to say this, I don't want the condition, otherwise these other methodologies would be acceptable, okay, to reflect time value of money. I say it's consistent with the principle or whatever. In the basis, I would describe that when it's that the only way that all these other methods that we're going to say are acceptable are not methods that look at the inability to collect both principal and interest. They're methods that are based off the inability to collect principal. And that would be consistent with time value of money if you were collecting virtually all the cash flows, because principal and interest discounted at the original effective interest rate gets you back to principal. But in this setting, when you're not going to collect a significant amount of principal and interest, discounting it at the original EIR, you're going to bring you back below the original principal. And we should just describe that, but say because of the impracticality of being able to do a full discounted cash flow model, this is in the basis, the impracticality of doing a full discounted cash flow model at a portfolio sort of level, we accept these other methods as reflecting some form of discounting, but not necessarily the principle that's accepted. It just ended that way. But that's a basis discussion in the standard to say these other ones are acceptable.
But why not explicitly say that they're practical expedients?
Because I think the worry was either you could say it's a practical expedient and just stop, an acceptable practical expedient. I think Russ just said he's worried that in those settings, when you use the word practical expedient, perhaps auditors would insist on you proving that it is an
expedient. I think that that's a case if, well, I think there's two kinds of practical expedients. One that we define as a practical expedient, and, you know, in all cases, or ones where we say companies can use a practical expedient, and that's, I think, the case that Russ is worried about.
Go ahead.
So it seems like we could deal with that, whether we call it a practical expedient or not, by saying, and therefore, you know, doesn't need to be compared to the full test in order to use it. I mean, I think that might take some of the pressure off.
If we say something is a practical expedient, doesn't it effectively do exactly that? I mean,
could we say something like an entity could use various methods to comply with this principle, including DCF, loss rate methods, and list out the three that those are the, you're including these.
Let's focus on today about whether or not we want to specifically put these in, and then we can describe what our basis should be. But Stephen?
Are you going to define the loss rate method, and why is it plural?
A great question. I don't think we would have defined what a loss rate method is. The plural versus singular.
I've done two loss rate method calculations. Yep. One that gives the right answer, and one that gives the wrong answer.
Well, we're only doing the right answer.
Let's do the right answer.
Got to give the right answer.
But again, I think this gets back to just the overall thought about not being overly prescriptive on how you would come up with your estimate. And I appreciate the point of how you came up with your loss might be right and wrong.
I meant consistent with the overall principle that I asked you earlier about, which is principle of allowance equals present value of cash don't expect to collect. So if that's your principle, then it seems to me there are different ways of doing it. So if you're going to say loss rate matters plural and not define it, you effectively haven't got a principle.
Well, but the problem that we have is we have a non-accrual principle also, okay, which is really what screws up your ability to come up with the right answer. So you don't have that in your model.
I think it's more important is
it influences it.
In the right way of you doing it, even at the portfolio level, you would have to identify the time periods in which cash flows would not be collected at the portfolio level. Then what you'd take is the contractual cash flows minus those in those time periods to be the ones that you've got left over discounted in an EIR. I think in some portfolio, and you could do that if you had the ability to assign cash flows not to be collected at the portfolio level to a period. But I think that we are being sensitive that you cannot always do that. And in those settings, there is other methodologies that would be acceptable. It would not preclude somebody from doing what I just described if they can do it. But I think some of our board members are concerned that if you put the condition, if you can do it, there'll be a lot of pressure for you to allocate arbitrarily cash flows not to be collected to certain time periods. And that's the struggle, I think, in how to write this.
But if you don't do that, then a loss rate method only partially takes into account time value of money. It's not an approximation or a practical expedient. It only partially does it, and the extent of the error depends upon the EIR and the length of the loan.
Correct, and the amount of cash flows you're not going to collect because the discrepancy between the error.
The bigger the loss, the bigger the difference between the loss measured with discounting and not with discounting.
Exactly. That's why I think Russ, when I said the same thing last time at the Ed session, said don't put the condition on it. Just make it acceptable. But I don't think when we say make it acceptable, we can say it's consistent with the principle.
So the staff's proposing that we agree, and I'm now looking at the language in paragraph 22, that we actually put in specific methods that would be deemed acceptable. Now these. They're here today. We could always add or take out later. But right now, based on what's in front of us, who, by show of hands, would agree with this? So that's seven. Okay. Let's do the last issue.
All right. So during our outreach, several constituents indicated that it would be helpful to provide more guidance on items that management should consider when assessing current conditions and developing forecasts about the future. Many suggested that the FASB could leverage current regulatory guidance that provides considerations for making qualitative adjustments to historical loss rates. The staff believes that it would be helpful to provide further application guidance on factors to consider when assessing current conditions and developing forecasts about the future. The staff believes the board could provide application guidance which largely leverages current regulatory guidance regarding qualitatively adjusting historical loss rates as currently described in the memo. So question seven for the board, does the FASB believe that the final standard on expected credit losses should include additional application guidance for assessing current conditions and developing forecasts about the future? If so, does the FASB agree with the staff's proposed application guidance that would leverage current regulatory guidance that provides considerations for making qualitative adjustments to historical loss rates?
Mark? My only point here is, what about expected TDR programs? like loss mitigation strategies. I know it's going to sound cheeky, but seriously, banks do say, you know, we're going to do a whole big loss mitigation strategy and do TDRs. Why would you not consider that here? I think you need to.
We'll agree on that TDR form.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't trying to be cheeky. I was seriously trying to be constructive.
Tom?
I actually don't think you have to say that here. If we make clear the TDRs are about determining the amount you're going to lose, because these things are all about determining the probability of a loss event and it being adjusting the base historical condition for the current conditions and reasonable supportable forecast. So if we separate those two things, I don't think they overlap, and I think you're nodding to agree. But I think it's important.
You're right. What my point was about the measurement of the expected loss, and it is about measurement of the expected loss, but in a different part of it.
Right. So we have to find a way to distinguish probability of a loss event from the measurement amount once you have a positive probability of loss that's been adjusted for all this current information.
Okay. Any other discussion?
Can I just ask a clarification? So in your first question, I think you voted on wording that included the entity is expected to revert to the unadjusted historical average. So if you vote yes to question 7, does that mean that you then actually revert to an adjusted historical average? Yeah. So the two.
Right. One observation before a vote. I think we have to make clear when we do this. We just, a prior vote said you have to have multiple scenarios, but that was for the base through the time estimate. I don't think we want to imply here that these qualitative adjustments to that base for this information have to, by definition, have multiple scenarios. They have to be supportable by evidence, but it doesn't have to be a probability-weighted estimate for the adjustment. And I don't want people to get confused about the prior vote affecting the adjustment.
Who agrees with the staff recommendation in question 7? 7? Okay. I know there's another question in the public paper, but we're not going to do it today. And it has to do with the operationality associated with the auditing. And we're going to have more research related to the auditing standards board, the PCOB, and how it will potentially be inspected.
Russ, could I raise one general question? most of the wording in here that's being changed or added to is converged wording at this stage. So that we're going to need to change as well, otherwise we'll get to different lifetime measures.
And I hope we can have a converged solution in lifetime measures.
Yeah, all of these questions are applicable to you, I think.
Yeah. But, yeah, you're making changes that we haven't considered yet. That's basically it.
Okay.
That's why we wanted to have the discussion with you. So you'll be in a position to understand. And to the extent that things change and you're able to make improvements, we'll continue to work with you to try to come up with a converged solution on this.
Okay.
There is an important difference, though. In your model, many of the measurements of lifetime losses will be on individual instruments. And ours more will be on portfolios of instruments. So some of the stress we're working with here is dealing with portfolio of instruments. Well, I'm not saying that there won't be, because much of the discussion you just had is that a lot of the time, especially if you do this top-down approach, you're going to be identifying the change in risk factors to individual instruments and moving only portion of the portfolio. When you do that, and in your stage 3, all of those are individual instrument lifetime measures.
I didn't get that out of that meeting. But I saw sub-portfolios, sub-segmentation, but not individual loans.
Yeah, agreed.
Good luck doing individual loans if that's where you're going.
Yeah.
Most of it will be portfolio.
Yeah.
Can I ask a process question?
Much of today was discussing lifetime approach. Is there a point at which we'll discuss whether or not we continue to think lifetime is right? Then if so, recognition in the income statement, so whether it should come in over an emergence period. I'm particularly interested in that issue, especially if it could result in any possibility of a converged solution, and maybe it can't, but it's more of a process question.
You want to take it?
Sure. Well, so just today, the staff was talking about really what is effectively the next step out of this, right? So we just went through the clarification or some wording clarifications on lifetime. The next question is, what is really the next significant memo that we're going to bring back to the board? And so certainly one of the areas or avenues that, you know, we're going to at least pursue and go down is kind of a change to the income statement. You know, what does that mean? You know, what kind of model does that really get to? And then from there, we can kind of flush that out, talk about that a little bit more, and then talk about other aspects of a lifetime model as well. And then we'll see where we go from there.
Yeah, it seems to me we need to and I think we're almost there on how to determine lifetime losses. Then I think we need to consider when to recognize those lifetime losses, and I think there's multiple methods. There's day one, which is what we proposed, and we got feedback on. There is, and I know we've had an education about over loss emergence period and how you do that, and I think the staff's going to come to some views about how to do that. And then there is the method that you guys voted on earlier today about the objective would be only after a significant credit deterioration. But those seem to be the three tastes to how to move it forward. Larry?
I'm just curious when we're going to get to a point where it becomes obvious to people whether we're going like this or going like that. I mean, you know, we had education sessions a month ago where various, or small group meetings, I should say, where individuals gave their views, et cetera. It seems to me that what's required is for each board to say, okay, what's my drop-dead issue? And identifying what those drop-dead issues may be, and then saying, okay, is there room for reconciliation of those to a converged solution, or is there not? Because, let's face it, you know, the world is watching.
Since long.
I didn't hear that.
To answer your question?
For quite some time.
And the more we separately deliberate, the more we're going to lock in things where we're not going to come to the ability to hear each other.
I think the discussions we had today were important because changes we make to our model are relevant to your thinking, and changes you make to how you calculate lifetime is relevant to our thinking. So I think we wanted to have some of those discussions first, so we were all sort of more informed of where the direction of the different models might be before we have that discussion.
Now, I guess the key is we're going to come up with a view on how to consider recognition of lifetime losses over a loss emergence period. Is that something that you'd want to do with us, or something you'd want us to kind of do on our own and then present the aspects of that so that we have three potential alternatives to vote upon?
Yeah, I think that would be a good idea, that you further develop your ideas on that, how you would like to run the P&L. Okay. And that would give us some food for thought.
Should we take a 10-minute break before we do revenue?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Great.